Take some questions. Yeah, Carl, do you want to kick off again?
This thing about the idea of internet anarchy being something of the late 19th century, you're probably right about the terminology, but in a way the concept, really I think you should put it back, you know, to the 17th and 18th century, obviously Westphalia, all the rest of it, but most importantly, I mean, Kant's idea that, you know, an international, a world state would be the greatest tyranny. And in order not to have a world state, you have to have a series of states. I mean, you would like to have nice states eventually that would come together. And you get to cosmopolitanism, which is what we spoke about today. So I return to this guy, Mervyn Frost, who's basically saying what you're saying from a kind of liberal point of view, re-describing it, saying that you have an anarchy of states that's ruthless and heartless and not very nice, and then you have another anarchy, not of international organization, he called it international civil society, right? Mm-hmm. And so these two things play, you know, again we get to Alex's idea, we're talking balance of power in some ways, that in the present day world, where we have international law and international organizations, where NGOs use international law across borders to limit the power of states, and they do actually to some extent, he theorizes it that way. He's not theorizing anarchy in the sense that, you know, that would go to an anarchy, because he says you always have these states, he's not an anarchist, but he's also trying to understand the role of international civil society. I think that's a term that should be used to understand this. The other point I would say is that, you know, in the 18th century what you see is the idea, you talked about Scott, this idea of areas becoming gobbled up by things that are state formations, not empire formation, tribal formations or federations like the Hanseatic League or things like that. And so therefore you get literature on, for instance, pirate utopias, pirates on the Spanish Main that you have people have written about very interesting, which links up with, you know, the present day ideas of temporary autonomous zones. And then the other idea, of course, is the human beings themselves. And that's the Arendtian idea that eventually in a world of states, if you fast-forward it to the 19th and early 20th century, you know, the secret message of the modern world is the refugee, because the refugee is outside of the state system and wants the right, you know, the right to have rights. So all of this can actually be repackaged in a kind of radical liberal way, like I think Frost is doing with these two anarchies. And I think he's onto something because, you know, for instance, if you look at the Geneva Convention, you know, why don't they just all tear it up? You know, no one really obeyed it, but they don't because of the pressure of these two anarchies, basically, if you look, which is something I've written about. And this isn't an anarchist argument, but it could be appropriated into an anarchist argument at some point, almost in the kind of syndicalist idea that Sorel would say, where civil society takes over from the political society, this Proudhonian idea that you might like, that way of looking at it. I mean, you could do that operation at some point. But I think this is a way of conceptualizing, and not just transnational organizations, but international civil society versus the other anarchy of states.
Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, I go into a little bit more detail on this in the paper. Yeah. Go back to your first point. Yeah, I mean, this is actually something, I actually start with Hume. I don't go into any great detail because I've got limited space in the paper. But what I do argue in that is that, yeah, you know, it's not, you know, I hedge around my arguments that this is actually a product of the late 19th century. I hedge it around with that, and I bring up the issue of Hume, because you have Hume there talking about the balance of power.
Yeah.
But I do point out that with Hume, and I think this is true of the writers in the 18th century and early 19th as well, is they're not actually interested in the global and the international. Hume is not.
Kant is.
Well, yes and no. Not really. You can interpret their interest in the world outside of the state as actually more of a case of keeping away the nastiness of the world outside the state, so the state can be perfected as a utopia. And I think you certainly get this in Kant.
Yep.
I mean, Kant's actually much less radical, you know, than people think. You know, they think, oh God, yeah, perpetual peace. You know, Martin White says he's a revolutionist. well, actually, no, he isn't. I mean, if you read his stuff on the state, it's despite his sympathies for Jacobinism, it's actually deeply conservative. He doesn't even support, he supports the idea of hospitality, but he doesn't support the idea of immigration. I mean, states are kind of these agrarian, self-contained entities. And this is why I say the importance of the Industrial Revolution is that it destroys that cosy agrarian compromise, which allowed people like Kant and Hume, who were very different and had very different ideas, but it allowed them to have a view of the international. I mean, in some respects, their international theories are it's hobby theorising.
Right.
It's secondary to what really concerns them. And I'd say also, even with that, with Westphalia, there's a hell of a lot of evidence now that really the concept of the Westphalian system is an invention of 19th century historians. Right. There's no concept of a Westphalian system prior to that.
Yeah.
I think you're right. We have to go back, but I think we have to go back in some respects to actually see what a sharp split does happen in the 19th century. You know, when I say sharp, you know, it happens over over decades. But I mean, I think there is something that happens very profound that leads to what we, which then becomes what in international relations, it's sort of a genealogy of international anarchy. What becomes the international anarchy? Now, I'm actually also a bit more critical of it. I kind of present it there as a kind of a genealogy light, if you like, in the paper. I'm a lot more critical of the concept, and that really comes back, I think, to just your other point. Sorry, it's going on a bit, which is, you know, this. I think you're right that actually this is actually quite strong in the liberal literature as well, and I think there's a crossover there between people like Proudhon and people who are influenced later on by Proudhon, by people like Lasky, like Cole, like Matrani, even sort of other people like Tawney and so forth, who are liberal socialists. But they're not liberal socialists in the way that Held is. They're liberal socialists in terms of guild socialists. There's a combination of liberalism. So I totally agree, and I think that's your last point, I think, is a very good one. Sorry, that went on.
Chris, I saw your hand up.
Yeah, this was one for Luke as well, and I apologise, I haven't read your paper, so if you cover this in it, come and shut up and we can talk about it later maybe. But I was just going to ask about the categorical separation you seem to make between anarchism in the IR, in our context, and anarchy in the IR context. And the way in which that might sort of limit the capacity to action. I'm left wondering where we go. When you're reading people like Richard Ashley, there's almost a sort of an ability to play the two together and look at the disruption that can go through there. Whereas keeping that categorical separation and putting anarchy in quite a different place seems to me to sort of move borders against us for how to unsettle that and to put two positivist and epistemology onto the anarchy that exists. And I'm wondering sort of what you'd say to that.
I guess that's a good point. I mean, what I'm in danger of doing here, and I was trying to avoid it in the paper, much more difficult to avoid it when you're doing a 10-minute presentation, is actually avoiding falling into the very trap that Ashley talks about IR realists falling into, which is creating your own anarchy problematique, which in some respects, in the presentation, I think I probably do. I try to keep it a little more sort of fluid in the paper. What I sort of argue in the paper is that that there are major problems with the whole idea of the international anarchy. And the way it's presented. In that sense, I agree with aspects of Milner, Wendt, and certainly definitely Ashley on that one. And you're right, I don't think we should make too much of a distinction, but I think what I was trying to do there was sort of make a distinction, that people have made a distinction, that there is this idea of sort of international anarchy, that it's seen as defining the field. I mean, we heard this sort of Chris's paper as well, you know, in terms of the way that the field defines itself. And I think, you know, what we have to sort of bring back in is that, in fact, when we talk about and describe the world in terms of sort of the international anarchy, the world, that what we're doing is we are kind of assuming the state, assuming the primacy of security, and that, you know, we should bring in other ways of looking at the international, but not necessarily adding anarchy to it. Although, you know, Chris's idea of positive anarchy, I think, is quite interesting. But so, you know, bringing in aspects of transnationalism, civil societies, you say, that is something I missed out from the paper. Bringing in sort of issues of sort of non-statist alternatives of global governance, which, you know, are real and existing. So, your points are very good.
Okay, yeah. Was it a question for Chris, by any chance?
It was a question for Luke, and maybe for you actually. I would never have thought of using Joe Freeman, but I really enjoyed that. I thought that was great. But is it structureless? The international. Is there no form of international order? If we go back to our friend, the Social Democrat David Hill, the thing he gets very excited about, and he's been excited about it since about 1984, when he's talking about the post-sovereignty state, as though the sovereignty state has actually ever existed, but never mind. When he gets very excited about the European community, the European Union, as a form of organisation in which we can practice some form of post-statelessness. So you're arguing about INGOs and they manifest the welfarist aspect of the state. Yes, they do, lots of INGOs, very powerful campaigning within the EU, forcing welfare measures. So where does the idea of structurelessness and anarchy fit if we think about the example of the European Union? Is it a post-state thing, or is it simply, I've often called it a state-like thing?
There's a big literature in IR about how international anarchy simply doesn't exist.
I think that's a good point. I think that's a very good point. I mean, in some respects, yes, it doesn't exist, and I think this is something that that we have to sort of take on board. I think what I was taking from Freeman's piece here, what I found interesting about it was I was reading it. Don't ask why. I was reading it at some point, and I suddenly realised, as I was reading it, that what she was saying actually sort of fits much of what you could think of in terms of classical realist IR. And in this sense, I think you're absolutely right. Actually, large amounts, and I actually mentioned in the paper that in fact, since the early 20th century, this has been a major trend. Large amounts of the international is actually very structured. You're not free to declare war against anyone you like nowadays. It's no fun anymore being a great power. There are major changes. So it is structured, and I think this is part of the thing is that this is something that we miss when we look at the world, and we sort of immediately assume that we're dealing with an international anarchy. Where I think I find Freeman interesting and useful is her sort of applying it to the global level, and then sort of applying it, thinking about how we would envision an anarchist IR, is that sort of following her views, anarchist IR should not fall into the trap of realist IR, of going for a kind of a informal structured system, that there is a need at the global level for formal structures to allow for an elite that is accountable and to allow for voices to be heard. As we see with things like, for all its faults, the European Union allows countries like Ireland to sort of walk the world stage, which they wouldn't otherwise do. A weak voice is able to be heard because of structures. If that answers that. Kind of answer, yeah.
And just add a comment on that, unless you want to.
I wanted to ask you some questions, unless somebody else has got a question for Chris, because he's been let off.
I have a comment on that last question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, terms of looking at a practice of using anarchy as an organizing principle, and then broader than that is looking around at structure, I mean, certainly in North America, you could characterize IR scholars above anything else as structural fetishists, that they just... We sit there, come up with structures, we look at structure, we think about structure, people critique our thinking about structure and so on, and it keeps going and going. And I think maybe one of the reasons for this, and especially the prevalence of using anarchy, aside from maybe some legitimate arguments that it does have some explanatory power in certain topic areas, is that it's good for the good. It's perceived perhaps as necessary in terms of the sociology of the discipline itself. That anarchy sets IR scholarship out from comparative politics, with these various, I don't know how it's cut up in in the UK. I know you guys have like IR departments that are separate from political science. But certainly in North America, there's this sort of, you're under a political science department as an IR person. And this idea of war, conflict, and anarchy seem to be sort of the central tenets of IR. And if you suddenly lose anarchy or structure as one of them, then what are you doing, right? Yeah. So I think that's why it just keeps sticking for some reason.
And in fact, I'm
going to have to insist that unless anyone else got a question for Chris, I'm going to ask mine.
Can I ask a question for Chris? It's not a question, actually. It was just asking you to elaborate on what you meant by broadening anarchy. So I had a look at the paper on the train coming over, and I really enjoyed all the discussions in the early parts of the paper, but the conclusion, broadening of anarchy?
The conclusion really got chopped down and is now getting bigger again for various reasons. And other parts of the paper are getting smaller and so on. But anyway, I guess what I mean with the broadening of anarchy, and this isn't, we actually had to take sort of our deep discussions of the existing literature and kind of going through the various things out and turn it into a whole other paper, because the thing got to like 30,000 words. The idea of broadening anarchy is simply to, and this may not be clear, especially in the draft of the paper that I think went up on the website, which is totally my fault because I hadn't sent you our. The idea of broadening anarchy is to simply think of anarchy, so positive anarchy, right? There's a whole bunch of different things you could do with that. So one of them would be to look at particular classical anarchist theorists and what they say about individuals in an anarchic system, right? And then use the domestic analogy, even though that's problematic, and apply that to a certain set of political actors at the international level. And you'd get different explanations of what's going on, but you wouldn't have junked anarchy as an organizing principle of the structure. So that's the idea behind broadening anarchy, is to sort of admit that IR scholars' use of anarchy is often, I mean, Alker made this this point in the 80s, I think, is usually crypto-normative or has some sort of values behind it. So admit that and then construct a vision of anarchy or a structure of anarchy that we can theorize from, where anarchy is actually sort of good, I guess, i.e. it's not the source of the problems of the international system, that those might be located elsewhere. As a classical anarchist would probably theorize it if they were not concerned with individuals, but concerned with international political actors. So that's sort of what we were getting at with that. Yeah. I don't know if that's, unless you're still like, well, this just isn't broadening, or I don't know, yeah.
Right, it's work in progress, it sounds like, you're going to develop.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask my question for Chris, if that's okay. It's actually a series of questions, so I'm sorry about this. So first, you made a comment that you've got two poles, and you've got your individual at one end and your totality, that you can't have an anarchy of one. And one person, that's a totality. So just as a sort of a heuristic way of conceptualizing how this works, you can only have an anarchy if there's two or more people.
Right.
Okay. And when you talk about states and IR theorists thinking that all the solutions to this international anarchy ought to be verged towards sort of totality, I think that's not quite accurate. Most IR theorists are quite happy to maintain an international anarchy for precisely the reasons that anarchists are quite happy, because it maintains the autonomy of states. So you won't find a single IR theorist, except for people like Chase Dunn that we saw at ISA, who's quite happy to call for a global state. Most people will not call for global states. And the reason they don't call for global states is because they want to defend the autonomy of the US, their role in the world, whatever, in these informal structures. However, okay, so nobody, as far as I'm aware of, calls for a totality, at least in the mainstream IR, and that's in the American stuff as well. My third point is that, what exactly are you doing by bringing anarchism in here? Because, I mean, it seems to me you're trying to bring anarchism into mainstream IR, stir a bit, like liberal feminism, and then see what comes out at the end. I'm not sure that's a very fair thing to do to anarchism, frankly, because the types of IR that you're trying to fix using anarchism are pieces of IR that, frankly, I would rather just jettison altogether. And it would seem to me to be a much more worthwhile thing to use the sort of insights that you've gained about how to conceptualize international politics as a project in its own right. Because I don't think we're doing anyone any favours by saying, hey guys, Morgenthau, or Waltz, why don't you start reading some book, Jim? That'd be great. You'd be able to sort out America's foreign security problems within about 6 weeks. You know, that's not, I think, what anarchism ought to be for, frankly. So that was more of a sense that I got from the paper or from your presentation. So I just maybe you should reflect on that. And then, because you did cover quite a few things at the end, and I was wondering if you just pull out that one thing, you know, the key thing that you think that anarchism helps us understand about international politics, because you covered a lot of ground at the end there, and I wasn't keeping up. You were talking about Stirner and democratic peace and all sorts of other things, and I just wasn't keeping up. So if you just, like, which is the one that you think does the most work for us in IR, and helps us really understand world politics in a better way? Yeah, if you just... and then just a quick comment for Luke, if I might, as well. I mean, we've made the point here that perhaps anarchy doesn't exist, and people like Andrew Linklater and Colin White, I've had this conversation with Colin White, he's very clear, there is no such thing as anarchy anymore, everything is structured, everything is interrelated, there is no anarchy, all right? When he said that, I was baffled. One of the interesting things about the removal of the sort of sovereignty, it's not that it removes anarchy, precisely produces that sovereignless society in a different way, right? So what we've got now is an anarchy that's not populated by states, but a much more complex anarchy, something that should help us understand anarchy. It's still an anarchy, but it's more like an anarchist anarchy because states aren't the major actors. So what we're doing is by reconceptualizing, we're also helping us understand how the social order is changing. And I think this is where people like Held, Andrew Linklater, Colin White and others, they really help us understand the international as a social order that is structured, but it's anarchic still, but it's anarchic in very different ways because it's post-statist. And I think that by maintaining that concept of anarchy, we get a much stronger purchase on what's going on, and it helps us understand the world from an anarchist perspective because we're not fetishizing the state. Anarchy's still there, we don't need to fetishize that, but the state has been the thing that's basically produced this concept of anarchy that Luke was talking about, not the stateless world, which I think Linklater, Held, and others have talked about since the 1990s.
Okay, so I'll start. The anarchy totality spectrum. So of course, yeah, you can't have an anarchy of one. The way the spectrum is pitched in the paper, and it might not be clear enough, is this is how social contractarians are treating, essentially, the concepts of anarchy and totality. Those are terms we give them, but they don't. But essentially that, in the state of nature, in which there's no ruler, so it's technically an anarchy, right, in that sense, the units of the state of nature, so people, are essentially free except that they have to interact with other people, and occasionally that's going to lead to cheating, or if I go to sleep, someone may come and take all the apples off of my tree while I'm sleeping, and so on and so forth. So in that sense, the kind of... sort of the ideal type of the good things, i.e. the good portions of that, is that man would ideally be kind of free from these problems that are created by other people. And thus the extreme pole is just one guy, in which there's sort of no society other than whatever he creates himself in his interaction with material reality. And then the solutions to this are to introduce, you know, what we call totality there, which is to basically mitigate the problems of interacting with other people by, you know, forming a contract or whatever that coercively forces everyone into certain positions. So I don't know if that really answers your question. The anarchy term there could be junk. As I said, I wasn't referring to it as a structure, but sort of a concept in social contractarian of the free human, right? It's sort of very individualist, right? Autonomous from all constraint, including sort of constraints that are put on them by other people, because that's the root of the problem in social contractarian theory, is that there's other people, there isn't just one person. In terms of the autonomy of the states, I'm trying to remember precisely the question you asked, that there are many IR scholars who are happy that states versus like a world state kind of thing, or
anarchy. Anarchy was something that was defended by most contemporary IR theorists. Post-war
versus
the you made the claim that basically, particularly North American scholars were looking for totality as the solution to anarchy.
I would say no, not totality in. I mean, world states usually like Kant rejects the world state for three different reasons. For example, no, I wouldn't say like on the other. we're not trying to go to the other pole, but usually the way that solutions to violence are theorized in the security community's literature, the democratic peace literature, neoliberal literature about creating institutions that can move us into Pareto optimal versus suboptimal outcomes and so on. You can link the sort of, oh, this is why, you know, there's cooperation rather than violence. You can link that back to, maybe it needs to be done more explicitly, but it's a word count battle, so. You can link that back to ideas about analyzing what's going on, what is producing the cooperation, by looking at what produces cooperation in social contractarian context. That is, create institutions around agreements that mean that autonomous states can still be autonomous as the liberal autonomous person is in some kind of contract position, but that the problems that there are other states don't interfere with your autonomy. So that's kind of the connection we're making there. I forget what the last question was.
Don't worry about it.
No, but it was the most critical question. So,
what's the key? What's the one thing?
Yeah, we should talk about that at the pub. No, I would say the one. It's hard because you can't treat, and we try not to. We try really not to treat anarchy as like anarchy. So there's all these various branches of anarchism and so on. I would say the one like sort of overriding would be to, and this kind of latches on to sort of a bit of a discussion we're having about, you know, whether anarchy exists or whether it should be junked or whatever, is we would make the argument that anarchy appears to be sticking and it keeps going on and on and on, and mainstream IR, at least in North America, seems to not be able to get away from anarchy as a concept. So even though we might like in an ideal world to jettison these things, I think IR might be better if we can at least try and fix them. But that's just something, I mean, there are good arguments, I think, to be made for both sides. So anyway, for the purpose of this paper, we're sticking with A. Let's just try to fix it a little, rather than get rid of it, even though the ship may be sinking, you know, we'll just keep plugging holes as fast as we can. The idea would be, A, to relocate, say, the sources of violence and uncertainty from structure, which has happened in most of the responses to WEMP that still deal with anarchy and the new literature about hierarchy, for example, is explicitly around making social contracts. That's Lake and the other guy, Donnelly, and so on. The next ISA, for example, the International Studies Association, the conference theme is hierarchy and re-envisioning these different types of structure. And the sort of the argument we're making is most of these re-envisionings are still sort of couched in, well, the structure's got new leaders, so there's violence. So if you take sort of a broad, writ large anarchist approach to that, I think what you do is you, A, reveal that there's sort of a value-laden assumption there, and that, B, what we can do is pitch another form of anarchy that's still value-laden, but sees a structure with no leader is emancipatory, and structures that do have leaders as creating violence and coercion. So it relocates the source of violence in international politics to something like the sovereign state. And then another thing I think that is good, which you actually just basically said when you were finishing your questions, is that it also makes us look at the state in a different way in terms of international ontology, separating state and society, whether states or society is possible outside the state, and all these things that came about as a result of political theory and the Enlightenment, when those two things were separated, and so on. So anarchy writ large, I'd say then particular types of anarchy have other things to say about some mainstream problems, and then probably on a more critical edge about other problems too. The problem is really that there's so many of them that you kind of have to pick and choose and be very brief.
All right, very briefly, it seems that we're actually kind of agreeing on what the substance of this is. What we're disagreeing over is whether or not we call it anarchy or not. Personally, I suppose it's just my personal preference, but coming from IR, I feel that the concept of the international anarchy is so loaded and so discredited that my feelings have just dumped it.
I think that's a shame.
I remember, the last part of your question, that you don't think this is good for anarchist theory. It probably isn't. Unfortunately, I don't know. Our feeling is that it seems a bit absurd to have this whole discipline around the idea of anarchy as a structural organizing principle without trying to see what classical anarchism can say about that organizing principle and its use. And this is just sort of one thing we thought about that. But certainly, there's definitely dangers in misrepresenting classical anarchism or sort of subverting many of the aims of the classical anarchists. On the other hand, at least they're maybe in the same way that protesting the G20 or whatever, it gets a certain dialogue going. This might be a way for mainstream IR scholars to kind of stop and think seriously about anarchists and get out of the Hobbesian anarchy, A, and get away from anarchists as, you know, these crazy bomb-throwing guys. So I'd say there may be some misrepresentation or whatever in an ideal sense, but in a very practical sense, perhaps you've got to find some sort of compromise area to get this stuff taken more seriously and thought about more so we can have more conferences like this.
That was a good answer. Okay, any questions?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, a question for Luke. You talk a lot about sort of low politics international organizations in the paper. And, you know, I wonder, and I think this goes with the comment on civil society, as opposed to international organizations, is to who has access to those organizations, mm-hmm. and is that any more elitist than a sort of representational politics creating some sort of political aristocracy that anarchists would certainly find problems with?
Mm-hmm. That is a good point, I mean, it's something that I have done some work on in term through the writings of David Petrani, as Alex knows. You're absolutely right. I mean, the problem is, yes, you can look to international organisations and say, well, look, these do provide an alternative. But you're absolutely right. Many of them, of course, are sort of state-based. They can often be very distant and very elitist. But I suppose that doesn't necessarily, just because that tends to be the nature of many international organisations, it doesn't, and organisations involved sort of transnational relations, it doesn't necessarily of itself mean that international organisations, the idea of international organisations and the idea of transnational links are themselves, you know, totally discredited. And so there is quite a lot of work done by quite a number of people in within international relations in the sort of 30s, 40s and 50s. Who were talking about the issue of functional democracy and the issues, and you see this with Mitrani's work on the Danube and River Authority, which was sort of based on the sort of work he'd done on the TVA, which he was talking about a new kind of democracy in which those who are involved in a function, which includes people who are consumers, producers, transporters, have a say. And actually, this also crops up, if anyone's interested, it's not his best book. H.G. Wells's Men Like Gods, I don't know if anyone's read it, it's not his best. It's boring, actually. And I like H.G. Wells. But H.G. Wells, it's written in the 20s, and he uses work from Howard Lasky. And there is this concept there of, again, of sort of functional democracy. And actually, Lasky is mentioned in the book.
Wells was a guild socialist.
Yeah, he had the link exactly to guild socialists. Absolutely. So there's this link between guild socialism on the one hand and ideas of sort of transnational democracy, although they didn't call it that. But there is a link, and of course when you mention coal, I immediately, yes, yeah.
They all read Proudhon.
And they all read Proudhon too. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, Carissa.
It's just a thought, really, rather than a question. About if we were to approach these kind of questions about structures and structurelessness and conflict and violence and so on from an international political economy point of view, the questions might be different in a quite useful way. So there'd be no question about structures or structurelessness. That's taken for granted. But debates about maybe hollowing out of states that might be useful for us in this context and contrary structures of globalisation. I mean, it's interesting in this case, those aren't words we're using. We're not using words like development or globalisation or or hollowing out and so on, and that's a terminology that's much more familiar in political economy context. But that's a bridge that might be very useful for the kind of developments that we're trying to make in this field. To think about contrary structures, you know, structures in tension with each other. There's no real question about structure in that sense. And then you'll talk about hierarchies and so on. We can make sense of all that by maybe including more terminology from a political perspective. And I think that probably speaks to a wider debate about tensions between those two international disciplines and stupid gaps that there are.
I mean, Alex, what you said about the end of the state, I was going to think about the same thing that Philip Cerny and my colleague Georg Mentz, who talk about competition state, flexible states. Also, if you look at the management of migration, you have the same idea. You know, borders aren't borders anymore. It's human beings who are the borders where you monitor people, all this kind of thing. Didier Bigo talks about this. So you've got all that from the Freudian point of view. So, I mean, I don't think the state has ceased to, it's just a different reformulation, this idea of the flexible state. And there's a hierarchy of flexible states. I mean, the British state's a lot more flexible than the state of Chad.
Right. Can I just interject?
Using different resources.
I mean, talk about these things. I mean, there's no assumption in the anarchist literature that anarchy precludes hierarchies. I mean, every anarchist will tell you, sit around in a room, somebody's going to dominate the conversation. Look at me. You know? These hierarchies and false hierarchies emerge under anarchy. I think there's a number of different interpretations and meanings of the term that are getting used here that are quite distinct from one another. I mean, or at least they're not what we actually mean by anarchy is not being really discussed clearly, I don't think. Because I think as Luke made a very important point, international anarchy comes with so much baggage that when you start thinking about alternatives to international anarchy, you kind of, I mean, it's like, where do you go, and then we start, and so on. And I think, the simple definition of anarchy is without leader, right? And what the classic definition of the international system is that it has no leader, ergo it's an anarchy. The mere fact that states become superseded by multilateral institutions doesn't detract from the fact that there's still no leaders there. And that what it does do is it undermines the statist core that was there in the first place. So the state is being transformed. I completely agree with you, Professor. And I think that social process is what I think, this is where I think anarchism could have most to offer, because and I think that's where Held's going, is how do you conceptualise political agency, how do you talk about subjectivity, how do you talk about the right things to do, the normativity of it all, without some sense of a political philosophy that can deal with politics without a leader. And I think anarchism is the only one situated to do that.
That's one thing, but what you're saying, you see, the point is I think you're anticipating is that we're not there yet. I mean, states, powerful states can use these tools to deal with migration. I mean, practical issues I'm talking about, and other forms of political economy to manage migration, to manage competition, especially since the end of the Cold War. And that's just a reformulation of this system. It's not being superseded yet. But it's true that there are things that go beyond the states, various different international and regional organizations that bind them in any different ways. But I think, again, we get back to, you know, to my friend Frost. It's the interaction between these two things, and that's not a normative question. He's not doing it normatively. He's doing it, again, of course, everything's I know, but anyway, he's trying to get pretty close to not being normative, you know, by saying there are these two kinds of anarchy, and let's just look at that.
Okay, well, there. Well, questions? I mean, it's now 20 to 6. Go ahead, Chris.
I'll try and be quick.
That's okay.
I just wanted to push you, Luke, a bit on the question of structurelessness and structure. And I was thinking about the contemporary critiques you're getting of the notion of security coming from people like Mick Dillon, Larry George, on the notion that trying to securitize things may well be the precondition of insecurity and the play there. And personally, I'm not that happy with structure, I'm not that happy with structurelessness, and it's more interesting to me to resist that dichotomy and to see what can be done between and through and with the two. And I'm just sort of wondering why you seem to prioritise one and where that sort of that securitising move seems to come from and almost where that goes and where we move with that sort of move to an international structure that tries to defy the power relations that are currently
Well, no, I suppose it's just sort of taking from Freeman and just sort of again, this is more part of the move that I'm trying to make in terms of saying, you know, if we're sort of answering the question, what would we require globally to have an anarchist world? So, you know, another word from that spins off, you know, what an anarchist IR should be. And I suppose the crucial thing that I'm taking here from Freeman, of course, is actually that structurelessness doesn't exist. And what you're talking about when you say structureless is actually informal structure. So I suppose the point I'm taking from there is that, you know, there needs to be a clear formal sort of structure. It can still be libertarian, it can still be democratic, it might even be hierarchical, but there has to be something there to allow, to make sure that you don't end up with. So that's why I was going with that. And I suppose, yeah, in a way, it does set up a dichotomy between a kind of the informal and the formal. I'll have to come back to you on that. Is that kind of...
That clarifies a lot of things.
Okay, we've got... I haven't seen any hands, so...
I've got one question.
Oh, go on then. Okay, well, I'll take this as the last question, unless anyone's got any burning questions. That gives us 2 hours to get to the restaurant, pub, by the pub.
Oh, me.
Hold this all up, Lou.
Sorry, then. Make it very quick, yeah. No, it's just because I really sort of enjoyed the paper, but there was one thing that sort of came out to me, in some ways it's related a little bit to what Alex was saying. It seemed to me that the paper was trying to find a positive anarchy because you kind of wanted to keep the domestic analogy.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you're kind of... do we need to keep the domestic analogy? I mean, could we just dump it? And is keeping the domestic analogy really just sort of falling for the sort of the realist blackmail that the international is unreformable?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. We struggled with whether to dump the domestic analogy or to sort of just open up positive anarchy, but not in domestic analogy terms. I mean, I guess the first thing you might think of, if the classical anarchists are talking about individuals in the state, or society that's non-state or whatever, it's very convenient if we're going to somehow connect theories of anarchy, because that's sort of what we're talking about, theories of how anarchy as a structural organizing principle interacts with the units in it, that it's most convenient to sort of approach mainstream IR, anarchy using IR, through a domestic analogy lens. So the same way IR has treated Hobbes, Locke, Kant, and so on, you just sort of add in, Proudhon or whatever, and then you get certain dynamics, or what you could call them logics of anarchy if you want, that are very different because they're not based in social contractarians, and that would make them positive anarchies. Just apply through a domestic analogy to, say, states. The other thing to do, yeah, is to remove the domestic analogy and then look at classical anarchist theories and see what they say about, like, the ontology that the social contractarian approach to anarchy through the domestic analogy uses. So one of those would be the domestic analogy, the state as an international actor or a potential source of cooperation versus conflict and so on and so forth. So it's a bit, that's a bit tricky. I think we'd like to kind of do both if we can. Start with the one because it's easier to get into, and then go to the other one where using classical anarchism in terms of critiquing the use of structure in IR becomes more critical and sort of less. So you dump the domestic analogy as an organizing principle as well. But if you have any ideas on that, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Don't dare. All right then. Let's thank the panel first of all. See, thank you. Okay, so we're at Kathmandu, the restaurant. It's opposite Colston Hall. It's in town. In 2 hours. Now then, go for a pint first, and we could all walk down there together. A group of 30 odd people, especially normal. Or we can all make our own way there. Well, I know a lot of people want to go back to the hotel, So we could all just sort of walk in that direction, have a drink at Racks, and then walk into town after that, while people are getting changed in the hotel or whatever. I won't have that luxury because I don't have a home room in the hotel. For those of you that do have a room in the hotel,
Alex, when you say getting changed, you're expecting us to dress for dinner.
Yeah, formal.
Formal.
Don't forget to mention.
Did you get the email?
I sent my dick.